the reading this evening is John and chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not of natural descent, nor of a human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. And the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth.
Could I say a very big thank you to Colin Hart and others here at the Christian Institute who very kindly invited me along to be with you tonight. It's a great privilege, actually. It's the first time I've had any dealings with the work of the Christian Institute, so it's a great privilege for me to be here. I've already posted these slides on this website, humbly called glynharrison.com, and if you go to the resources page there, you will see tonight's lecture, and you just press on the button, and you'll need a password, which is Newcastle. And you'll get the slides down. And there are also, at the end of that, the main thing is a list of resources. Because obviously in tonight's talk, we are skating over some big topics in order to look at the kind of story that lies behind those topics. So it's the kind of talk that's very vulnerable to your saying, you didn't say anything about, or what about this, or I was expected to hear about that. You know, sometimes you have to stand back with a wide-angle lens rather than zoom in too quickly on some of the hot-button issues. And it's the wide-angle lens that I want to employ tonight, so please bear with me with that. Set in Ireland in the 1960s, the hit movie, you may have seen it, some of you, The Magdalene Sisters. Do you remember? It follows the fortunes of four young women who'd had children out of wedlock, trapped under a brutal regime of po-faced nuns running one of Ireland's infamous Magdalene laundry asylums, named after a repentant prostitute, reputedly. Hundreds of these asylums for fallen women operated across Europe and North America for the best part of 200 years. Today we would call these fallen women single mums. But as recently as the 1960s, when this film was shot, the shame of these women would keep them out of sight and out of mind, working in these laundries, sometimes for years on end. Some children were forcibly put away for adoption. Now, of course, these are extreme cases, but they illustrate something of the cultural scaffolding of shame that gathered around immorality and divorce generally in our society. I can remember even as a young teenager in the early 60s, my mother speaking of a woman who was divorced down the road, the tone of her voice, the dropping of the volume transmitted of the shame that was gathered around that status at that time. However, as the events in this movie were taking place, the early 1960s, which I'd gather looking around many of you would have shared as well, you will know that the West was on the threshold of a social and cultural upheaval that would see all of these asylums, every last one of these asylums, close down within 30 years, all around Europe, all across the States. A mighty sexual revolution was about to unfold with such speed and intensity that looking around us today, just 50 years later, the cultural landscape has changed beyond recognition, hasn't it? Today, nearly as many births take place outside of wedlock as take place inside wedlock. In socially deprived areas among the poor, that proportion has risen to 2/3. And marriage itself, once again, especially among the poor, has entered a deep and prolonged recession. Look at the number of divorces as they began to rise in the 60s. There it is. There's the Magdalene Laundry film. There's the early 60s that many of us recall. And as the 60s, the sexual revolution gets underway, the rates of divorce, and this is just the raw numbers of divorce, rockets, as you can see, sixfold. And then it begins to level off. In fact, it even fell a bit. So maybe if we just wait a bit longer, it'll all go back to where it was and we can all go home and stop worrying about it and you'll be out of a job, Colin. So, or maybe not. Because the likely cause of this plateauing of the raw numbers of divorce is, of course, that fewer people are getting married to get divorced anyway. So as the number of divorces begins to rise, these are the raw numbers of events once again over this period, 62, 72, 82, 90. You can see as the number of divorces here rises through the 60s, 70s, 80s, it begins to plateau just as the number of people getting married begins to plummet in our society. Thus, marriage, a deep and prolonged recession. Cohabitation and sex outside of marriage is the new norm. Today, two people of the same sex can get married, and anyway, we are no longer sure what sex, being male and female, means anymore. In the space of just a few years, across much of Western culture, centuries-old convictions rooted in the biblical moral code effectively collapsed. And most people today, and this is the reality we need to contend with, most people today would say good riddance. Church-going people are shifting on these issues as well, including those who would call themselves evangelicals, and worryingly, perhaps most of all, I think young evangelicals who don't say very much about these things, who don't tend to come to meetings like this in the evening, but in their hearts, at a subliminal, under the bonnet level of the mind's functioning, are moving and shifting, and they're not so sure anymore. And of course, we shouldn't be surprised about the scale and pace of this change, nor should we be surprised particularly that young Christians are beginning to weaken in their convictions in these weighty areas. We shouldn't be surprised, because for several years, many Christian leaders have looked and behaved like rabbits caught in the headlights. In reality, we seem to be hoping that if we keep our fingers crossed, the whole dreadful business is somehow going to go away. But it won't. It just keeps on coming. Whilst we sit here like King Canute, the waves keep rolling in, don't they? So I've got a question for you this evening, and here's the question that I want to put to you and that's going to guide the rest of this lecture. In Matthew 19, Jesus said this, some of the most significant words in the New Testament, echoed in Mark 10, as well as in Luke. Matthew 19. Have you not read that from the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. My question is this: for those of us who remain convinced that the traditional reading of this text is a non-negotiable of Christian identity, what does the future hold for your beliefs, given our culture? Well, let's turn around that around a bit and make it a little more difficult. What are you going to do to make those convictions plausible in today's culture? How can we begin to tell a better story to our culture that's so dislocated, so far adrift of its Christian foundations? It's a big question. And I suggest that we could start by listening to our culture a little more carefully and observing it more astutely. What is our culture saying to us? You know, the political theorist Joseph Nye, because I think with our culture we need to particularly ask what's the secret of the power of the sexual revolution? Why has it swept so much before it, so quickly and so profoundly? What's the secret of its power? And the political theorist Joseph Nye, you probably know, talked about hard power, soft power. Soft power is the ability to get what you want using attraction rather than coercion. It's what makes your way of looking at the world, your ideas and convictions attractive to people and say, I want to tell me more about that. I like something, stop that kind of speak, tell me more. I like what I see. Now, of course, the stormtroopers of this mighty sexual revolution are very adept at deploying hard power, coercion. And many of us have been on the receiving end of that. And it operates at all kinds of levels. It operates at being publicly shamed, which is a very hard thing to bear. But at a micro level, a micro-social level, if you're so unwise as a teenager to post a dissonant cultural view, say, about gay marriage, as an example, to see yourself unfriended by your contacts on Facebook is deeply, deeply difficult for a teenager to do. And it's a kind of a hard power coercion that operates, you see, at all kinds of levels. And we're used to, if anything, thinking about how to defend ourselves against that hard power. And the Christian Institute clearly have been in the vanguard of that and done much wonderful work. But I want to put to you that the secret of the revolution may not really be in its hard power, or at least that we've not sufficiently acknowledged its soft power, the deployment of vision and ideology into our culture that the human spirit finds deeply attractive. Now, let's suppose I'm right. Let's suppose I can carry you along with this so far. What are the sources of this soft power? Two things. There are lots of things, actually. And we could put a sociological lens on, we could put an epidemiologist lens on to look at some of these changes. But I just want to reduce this to two things as the secrets of its soft power. And it's these. First, its moral vision. And second, its particular brand of individualism. Okay? It's moral vision. Let's take the revolution's moral vision first of all, because I think this more than anything else is what caught us off guard and unprepared. You see, when it comes to questions of morality, Christians have been accustomed to occupying the moral high ground, haven't we? It wasn't difficult in the past to denounce deviations from traditional beliefs, to point to the evils of pornography and broken homes and sleeping around, because it fed into a broad public moral consensus. You know, we knew under the bonnet things were quite different. People had all sorts of secret liaisons and lives. But in terms of the general public consensus, Christian values were very much, until the 60s, in the mainstream of our culture. So when Princess Margaret falls in love with a divorced man, quote, mindful of the teaching of the church, unquote, she steps down. And that is the broad consensus that I speak of and into which we have operated for centuries. So we're used to being there on the moral high ground. And but when this revolution came along, we thought it would be business as usual. We expected to be able to portray our opponents as moral anarchists bent on depravity. But far from unveiling a Dantean nightmare of debauchery, the revolution cast an inspirational vision of authenticity, freedom, and fairness. Fairness. And it cast us as the degenerates, the hypocrites, the judgmentalists, the bigots. And for the first time in centuries, Christians are needing to face the reality that most people out there today, many people, view us as the immoral ones, an immoral minority. And this operates all kinds of levels. Let me give you an example. Take a gay pride event. Now, on the face of it, images like these, it looks easy. Faced with an image like this, it's business as usual. We wrinkle up our noses, we default to talking about AIDS or something like that, and we hold another seminar on pornography, and another seminar on pornography. But people aren't listening to our language. Today, images like this, we need to understand, convey virtue. And you say, virtue? What's the virtue here? It's the virtue of being real, just being honest about saying the way things are. The virtue of saying, you continue in your hypocritical shame cultures, if you like, but this is who I am. Now, this is the individualistic perspective of that too, the individualistic perspective of today's moral priorities, freedom, fairness. They pivot around the rights of the individual, freedom of expression for me, for the individual, the right to be treated fairly and justly as an individual. This is a moral discourse which takes place in the language of the individual. And often biblical Christians don't have a moral vocabulary that's capable of engaging with these individualistic concerns. And we respond to individual cases like this with rules and general principles. But people find it hard to get excited about our rules and general principle because they don't see how they bring authenticity and fairness to individuals. They can't see that link. They're used to thinking about individuals. So the person who find it most difficult says, you know, my son's gay, and I don't understand where you're coming from because you don't seem to get what he struggles with. And it's very much couched in the language of the individual. And you come in with your rules, you say, and this, leave your rules for 1 minute, because I'm talking about my boy, and I don't see how your rules lead to his flourishing. And that's the gap that we are challenged with, friends. So clearly one of the tasks that lies ahead for us is to find a language that connects with today's moral priorities. So first, a compelling moral vision. Second, I'd like to suggest that the soft power of the revolution relies on its ideology of expressive individualism. Of course, there are other ideologies and social changes driving the revolution that could keep us here for a few seminars, but I think the influence of expressive individualism has been potent. Now, what is it, expressive individualism? Well, let's take individualism first. What's that? In a nutshell, individualism, it's about the value of thinking for yourself versus what you're told by other people. Let's take that as a working definition. And clearly, your thinking, I hope, it's good to think for yourself. It's good to think for yourself. I remember when I failed the 11 plus, and then I failed it again. And it looked as if I was, after all, going to be going to the secondary modern school with the rough boys upstairs with the scuffed knees. And we were a working class family, but all the hope was that I would be the first in the family to be a doctor, which is what I'd always wanted to be, a doctor. But my grandmother, she said to me, but you know, Glenn, it was a great idea. Love your ambition. But you've got to understand, our kind of people don't do that kind of thing. Isn't it tragic? There's a generation of kids whose script is written that way. But there were two things that militated against that. First was I was a Christian. Even at that age, I sensed that the scripts written by other people were not necessarily the script written by God. This wasn't where my identity was rooted. And also, I was a child of the 60s. And the 60s were putting money into young people's pockets, and they were putting dreams into their hearts that they could do it. And that you don't just take the scripts written to you by your elders and betters, but you get out into the world and you do it for yourself. And that is a kind of individualism that I think we'd say, well, good on you. It's good to think for yourself. But of course, that kind of individualism, which we'd argue as being rooted in the Christian gospel, a God who makes us individuals in his own image, a God who holds us accountable before him as individuals, we'd hold that kind of life-giving individualism is a balanced individualism in which thinking for yourself is held in balance with the wisdom of the ages and of our elders and of God himself. So it's a situated individual, an individual situated within a context. But modern individualism, something different. It tilts the balance of authority decisively in favor of the individual. Our highest loyalty is to the self. We see this modern imperialism of the self most acutely, don't we, in the sphere of personal identity. One of the most profound questions we'll ever ask is, who am I? And expressive individualism teaches us to look within inside ourselves for the answer. It's a kind of modern form of Gnosticism, really. Within every individual is a unique self, an inner me, and this is who you really are, and this inner me must be expressed to be truly yourself, to be truly authentic. That's why it's called expressive individualism. Look inside yourself and find the inner you and express the inner you. And that is what sets the person free. And if external realities, you know, external realities of authorities and their scripts, what other people say. No, more than that, if external realities of reality itself, your own body, doesn't fall into line with what you believe to be true of the inner me, then reality must fall into line, not your feelings. This is an imperialism of the self, you see, because the only reality that counts here is what I feel to be true inside. Let me give a couple of brief examples. According to the New York Times magazine, 2015 was the year we, quote, obsessed over identity. I think it's a bit of an exaggeration, but there's something in it. For example, in December 2015 of that year, a transgender father of 7 children, reportedly left his wife and family in Toronto to start a new life as a 6-year-old girl. A few months earlier, Rachel Dolezal, a 37-year-old white civil rights activist, but who looked like this, was accused by her parents of falsely portraying herself as black. "This is our daughter," they said. "She's masquerading in order to situate herself within the black civil rights movement." And again, reportedly, Rachel Dolezal said, "This is true." But she continued to insist, "I still identify as black. I identify as black." And that term, "I identify," is the one we need to hang on to here. Now, of course, these are extreme examples. And I don't put them up to mock these individuals. I don't know their personal story, and it's gleaned from a newspaper. And I'm not at this moment commenting on individuals with gender dysphoria who experience real pain and dissonance in their experience of themselves. But I'm concerned here with the vast majority of adults and children who have no gender dysphoria, but on whom gender ideology is being imposed. An ideology which repudiates bodily reality in favor of what you find within. A cultural trend that means the phrase "I identify as" is fast becoming a defining feature of our age. So we've seen how the moral vision of the revolution renders self-expression a moral duty. Here, we see how expressive individualism markets self-expression as a source of human flourishing. And as these two big cultural developments converge and interact, what's interesting is that they lend themselves to great storylines. They lend themselves to being woven together into the kind of inspiring human dramas featured in hit movies like The Magdalene Sisters, narratives about courageous women and men finding their voice, recovering their dignity, exercising their authority over the oppressive straitjacketing of tradition and religion. And in stories narrated over and over again through sitcoms and rom-coms, in documentaries and docudramas, you know, Will and Grace, Friends, Modern Family, these stories are told over and over again, and the human spirit finds stories deeply attractive because they engage us. They create empathy in us for the characters, and they hook us into a storyline here of the little people breaking out over the big people. And there's something about the human spirit we've always loved, David and Goliath. We've always loved the thought of the marginal person being lifted up. And so these stories of freedom and being yourself are deeply attractive. And we've got to get that if we want to understand our culture. It's been argued that in the States, the Supreme Court ruling in favor of same-sex marriage probably owed more to the show Will and Grace than to rational argument. I think there may be something in that. And there's the challenge. So we've tried to understand the soft power of the revolution with these great stories it has and this underlying narrative which we find so attractive. How does the church traditionally respond to these stories? We respond with facts and rules. And when the bishops of the Church of England are eventually flushed out to offer some sort of document about marriage, it reads more like the terms and conditions of a software upgrade than a manifesto for human flourishing. And our culture doesn't work like that anymore, and that's the nub of the problem. The sexual revolution has stories, a great narrative of freedom and authenticity, and what we have is facts and rules. How do we respond to this mighty revolution, to its soft power, to its ability to win hearts, minds? So for the rest of this lecture, That's what lies ahead, that question. How do we respond? I remember at this talking to some pastors along this line. One of them put his hand up, I hope what's coming next good, he said, because I'm depressed. And I think what I was tapping into, and these were younger guys, was a deep sense of familiarity with a struggle inside that many of them hadn't really articulated. And the struggle goes, I think I know what I'm against, but what are we for? What's our story? What do we bring that speaks of freedom and flourishing to this culture? How do we get started? Well, I've got a couple of ideas I'm going to pitch in, and it just gets us started here. How do we respond? I think we've got to do two things. We've maybe got to just think a bit more about our critique of this sexual revolution. Because often we do come over as being a bit hard, a bit concerned with beating down the little people. We don't get over to this revolution that we share many of its aims. Are we against flourishing? Who's against flourishing here? Who wants to see little people beaten down? None of us, I hope. I think it's called the gospel. I've come to, you might have life, have it abundantly. So we haven't always done that well, I don't think. And so what I'd suggest is that our better critique of this revolution starts with a better critique of us, ourselves, some honest self-awareness. And where we need to, let's come clean. In the 60s, the sexual revolution possibly did speak truth in some respects to our cultural power. We have sometimes been oppressive and judgmental and ununderstanding. And many of us have raised and continue to raise our young people in ignorance and fear about their sexuality and their being made sexual in the image of God and their erotic sexual longings and the changes that take place in their body when they're 12 and 13, and we tell them nothing. I remember I asked my granny, I said, I sensed this was a naughty word when I was about 8 or 9. And I said to my granny, Granny, what does the word pregnant mean? It's a naughty word. And she said, do you know what she said? I don't know. I don't know. I think she did, actually. She was my granny. Why was she frightened? Why couldn't she talk? What was the shame that stopped her, that made us ashamed of our bodies and their sexuality, and that somehow gives truth to... Don Schrader famously said, to hear some Christians talk, he said, you'd think that God invented the head, torso and the legs, and the devil slapped on the genitals. And he had a point. And the founder of Playboy magazine, he famously said, Hugh Hefner, that he founded that magazine partly in reaction to his oppressive upbringing in a religious family. We bring our young people up on what the Catholic theologian Christopher West calls the starvation diet when it comes to sex and relationships. This is something, one of the most important decisions we make is getting married. You're going to be sleeping with this, in the same bed as this person. We say so little about the how to get married and preparing for marriage and these feelings we have inside, what we do with them and what they mean. And we see pastors who trash their families and their lives for a night of sex with their secretary, fine Christians. And we know that sex is important to who we are, and yet we bring our kids up on the starvation diet. Now, of course, there are wonderful exceptions to this. And you'll say, this doesn't ring true for me at all. My parents gave me a fantastic upbringing and education. But unless this room is very untypical, and I've spoken on this a fair bit, I would wager that quite a bit of what I'm saying has rung true for many of us. And in the 60s, the sexual revolution came along, and it offered people the fast food diet. The fast food diet. You have it now like a McDonald's hamburger, ready wrapped, ready to go. You just need to pay, and it's yours. Now, if you're a teenage boy and the hormones are pumping around, what are you going to choose? The starvation diet or the fast food diet? What do you want? And our culture of shame kept many of our young people starved. And we need to be honest about that, I suggest. We have a good idea of what we're against, but what do we tell them we're for? So let's respond with humility. And where the sexual revolution forced us to face up to our broken promises of abundant life in this area, maybe it doesn't do any harm to own up. And also the sexual revolution, where there are people there right at the spearhead of it, but who show wonderful kindness and care. And they do care, many of them, about the little people. They genuinely care. Doesn't cost anything to recognize that. People still made in the image of God, even though we believe that image is desecrated by sin. It's still discernible there. People are deeply kind at times. And where we see kindness from someone with whom we profoundly disagree, let's acknowledge that. And so, on the one hand, our critique starts with ourselves. But then, having done that, having owned up to our failed promises, I think we're in a better position then to begin to critique the revolution in terms of its failed promises. And I suggest that's a good way of approaching this, rather than critiquing it on the basis of our views initially. Let's critique it in terms of what it promises itself. And just ask, can we in a conversation ask whether this mighty revolution is producing the authenticity, the freedom, the fairness that it promises? So let's set about that very briefly. And we could have another series of seminars now on this. We could explore the modern obsession with identity. Is expressive individualism solving the big questions of identity? Is our world better for this modern way of looking at ourselves? Or is it making us more narcissistic and insecure? In my book, The Big Ego Trip, I try to demonstrate how the evidence just stacks up to show that none of this self-absorption works. Social science data lines up to suggest it may in fact be increasing mental health problems. Certainly, there's no evidence it helps. I think that's pretty clear from the data. But it may even be suggesting it increases mental health problems rather than reduces them. So we could talk about that. Of course, we share with our culture that identity is important. We understand why somebody says, who am I? This is a big question for me. Let's say that. I understand that. We have that. That's a key question for us. But we see it we get to the answer in a different way. And we don't see any evidence the revolution is producing the goods in that respect. We could have a seminar on the pornographication of childhood and ask whether the revolution's attempts to defeat the shame that Christian culture imposed on our children around sex with the pornographication of childhood instead. Is that progress? Last year, the Children's Commissioner produced a report about pornography in childhood, and the title of that report saves me having to tell you anything more about its findings. The title is Basically, porn is everywhere. And I heard the children's commissioner said, you know, we can debate about whether age 12 a boy has, you know, 90% or 80% of boys have viewed pornography and so on. She said, basically, cutting to the bottom line, she said, porn is everywhere in childhood. And so we I think, would fairly own the shame that we surrounded our sex within childhood. We'll own up for that. But now let's turn to say, is this revolution delivering on its own promises in terms of children? But I want to focus on two things, really. First, the revolution's promise of sexual liberation and freedom. We would expect the revolution to have delivered its own particular brand of flourishing, surely in the form of more and better sex. You know, you take off the straitjacket of Christian culture, surely one of the things that would result from that is more liberated sex. People are having more sex and better sex as a result of this revolution. So how's that promise got on? Well, here are the data for actual sexual activity over the last three decades. David Spiegelhalter, it's a wonderful name for a professor of statistics, isn't it? Oxford. His book, Sex by Numbers, is a very useful review of the methodological problems around measuring issues related to sex, but also the data as it stands at the moment. Very accessible. But he teases that if you look at actual sexual activity amongst 16 to 44-year-olds, based on the most reliable survey evidence, we see that the kind of this median is the kind of average frequency of sex in the last 4 weeks. So how many times have you had sex in the past 4 weeks? That's the question here, okay? If you're aged 16 to 44. You can see in 1990, it's the same for men and women. In the 1990, it was 5 times a month. In 2000, it was 4 times a month. In 2010, it was 3 times a month. Why, says Spiegelhalter, by the year 2040, no one will be having any sex at all if this graph were to be unreasonably extended, as, of course, no statistician would. Well, I very much doubt that that will be the case, but it rather makes underscores the point that a revolution that promised more is delivering less. And one's reminded of the nature of idols, aren't we? They always promise more, more. You shall be as gods, more than you are. They're already made in the image of God. They have all that they could want to be, but the serpent promises more. You shall be as gods. But then they deliver less and less and less until in the end they have everything. You have nothing. So we could talk lots more about that, but my main focus on the failed promises needs to rest on children tonight. Why kids? Because I think Jesus loved kids. Our Savior loved kids. God loves kids. And the revolution may have delivered a kind of freedom and justice for some adults, but what if it has brought inequality, injustice, and oppression for others, our kids? What if it's our children who pay the price for our adult freedoms? My argument's premised on the observation that the biblical vision set out in Matthew 19, that one that Jesus sets out as he raises the bar again and takes his disciples back to creation and reinstitutes clearly for his followers that this is the standard. Simple observation that the biblical vision set out in Matthew 19, having a mum and a dad bound together by promises of lifelong fidelity, not simply made by God, but in a relationship that has been sealed by him. So not only promises made before God, but in a relationship that has been sealed by him, joined together by him. The simple observation that that view of the way we organize our lives, mums and dads, is good for kids. They love it. They thrive on that biblical vision. A group of academics from the Brookings Institute, a secular think tank in the States, thinking about our kids today, they summarized their review of the literature, the Brookings Institute and Princeton University. It's a joint report. Reams of social science and medical research convincingly show that children who are raised by their married biological parents enjoy better physical, cognitive, and emotional outcomes on average, just note that little word on average, we'll come back to it, than children who are raised in other circumstances. Now, we could have some more series of seminars on these kinds of data. They're complex, they're controversial, they're hard to untangle at times, but these researchers, as they've come together and brought together a multidisciplinary grouping, have said, we think that this is the best summary of the evidence so far. But we need to be clear about what these data mean. Families today come in all shapes and sizes, and many do a wonderful job, including probably among us here today. The important word there is on average. Of course, some marriages, some individual marriages, are really bad for kids. And some non-traditional families, such as adoptive same-sex parents, such as a single mum, those individual, occasionally, sometimes, those are very good for kids. But in the round, the welfare of children is best served by a culture that values the secure environment provided by two biological parents committed to each other in an act of lifelong fidelity, in a relationship enchanted by the institution of God himself. And this means that the instability of divorce is bad news for kids. The instabilities of cohabitation are worse news still. And yet, according to data from the Center for Social Justice, nearly one half of parents will split today before their children reach the age of 16. And the majority of the children of these torn relationships will live in lone parent households in which the father is absent, or in blended families with a different father figure, or revolving door father figures. Bad news for the flourishing of children overall. Overall. Now again, I'm going to underscore this. There are wonderful examples of courageous lone parents providing life-giving homes. Of course there are. And there are complicated debates about the precise causal relationships in play here. Does marriage itself create the stability, or is it the kind of people who get married who tend to be more stable? These are complex statistical analysis behind these data. The jury is still broadly out if you're looking to pin down the causal direction, but I think on balance, but then I'm biased. The data show that marriage has a magic of its own in producing stability. But the simple common sense genius of marriage is that it binds men to their responsibilities for the children they help to bring into the world. It builds a culture, or rather it builds what I call moral capital in a society, a culture of shared expectations and values that young men and women will pursue virtues of commitment and promise keeping. And when men and women take these responsibilities seriously and step up with love and commitment, children flourish. And what I suggest is that what this vision does for our children and what this building of moral capital does in a society is that it brings authenticity, freedom, and fairness to children. And so you can maybe see here that we're beginning to use some of the language of the sexual revolution, and we're beginning to connect it, but not simply with the concerns of me, but with the concerns of them, the most vulnerable in our society. And none are more vulnerable than a newborn baby. We've forgotten how great a revolution Christianity wrought in the Greek and Roman world in terms of its attitudes to children. We revolutionized that society. Our faith was born in a culture which placed kids at the bottom of the heap, and girls most of all. Have you ever thought to think why the disciples, who'd clearly been infected by this culture, as they were infected by the culture of divorce that was rife at the time, have you ever thought to think why the disciples, why it occurred to them that Jesus wouldn't want to see children? It didn't. Have you thought why they didn't assume that Jesus would want to see the kids? Why didn't they? Because their culture didn't see kids. They were not worthy of meeting the great rabbi. And Jesus begins the revolution as he cuts through his disciples and says, bring the children to me, because of such is the kingdom of heaven. And those early Christians, many of them martyrs, remembered how Jesus loved kids. And they remembered how the anger of God burned. His anger burned in the Old Testament against child sacrifice. And they brought to Greek and Roman culture a revolution of values. And they refused abortion. And they gave women a position that in many cases was strange to this culture. And they looked after their kids. And the pagans in the long run looked into this culture and they liked what they saw. They saw that it brings flourishing. And of course today, organizations such as Krish Kandaya's Home for Good do wonderful, wonderful downstream work of adoption and fostering for kids in care. But this is the upstream work. Building moral capital is the upstream work that helps to prevent kids getting downstream in the first place. And therefore, it's godly work and it's good work. So we've owned up to our failures and we've begun to pinpoint the failed promises of the sexual revolution. But we better not finish, although I know many of you will be wishing I would now, but we better not quite finish until we've said, okay, we've got the critique, but what is the better story? And there isn't a quick and easy answer to this. Ultimately, it's got to be found within your own heart. It's got to come from a real place of conviction that we have a better story. But for me, I think it's this. The Christian story, our vision for human flourishing, it doesn't begin, once upon a time there was me. In fact, we can understand why our culture was worried about identity, but we'd want to say that is a profoundly depressing place to begin a story. Me. In our story, it begins with God. God who is there. In the beginning was God. In the beginning was the Word. And I just wonder whether we've really got what good news that is in a culture which is looking inside itself, asking, who am I today? Because what I see today is different from the one yesterday that I saw, or maybe the one tomorrow, and the confusion and the erosion of confidence that's producing. No, in the beginning was the Word. And he was not silent. That's the beauty of the word, Word. He spoke. And God, of course, wonderfully revealed who he is, full of grace and truth. And we liked what we saw. We beheld his glory, glory as of the only Son, full of grace, truth, It's a great story. But here's where the story gets even better, given our topic tonight, because he not only revealed who he is, he revealed who we are, made in the image of God himself, in his likeness, his image bearers on this earth, as we see in Genesis 1, calling us. As he's creative in the universe, he puts us on his earth. He says, be creative and tend this place and make more of my world. And as he is fruitful and brings life out of nothing, he says, be fruitful. Bring more image bearers into this world. Bring a baby, a vulnerable little baby who bears my image, and nurture those children and love them as I love children. Bear my image with dignity. It's a vision of what it means to be human that at once puts the world at our feet. You know, in Psalm 8, he has put everything under his feet, meaning man's feet. What is man? You've crowned him with glory and put all things at his feet. This vision of being made in the image of God puts the world at your feet. It says to our kids, there's a world out there to conquer in God's name, to serve, to tend, to make more of. Bear his image well. But you don't need to make it up as you go along, because you're to be like him as you serve this great calling to make more of his world. So you're both given the calling, but also the boundaries of being in his likeness. The boundaries that create stability to your identity and a sense of continuity. Made in the image of God, male and female. And of course, as we read together, that broken image by sin transfigured to become the image of Christ himself. To those who believed, he gave the right to be called children of God. Born not of human flesh, but born of God. So the image is remade and transfigured to become to become like Christ. A view of identity which is both a calling full of opportunities, but also a boundary that keeps us safe and rooted, focused. The blessings of the gospel. And so with that story, I think we've got a great message about identity today. It's one of the great apologetic opportunities for us. Generates identity, it generates purpose and self-worth, our Christian identity. It's not discovered in the self, it is revealed to the self. And more than that, we believe that we flourish as human beings when we live in harmony with our identity. And so, again, we say to our culture, we understand why identity is important, because it's important for us as well. But we get there by a different route that doesn't begin with me, it begins with God. So we don't need to construct whole identities out of part identities like nationality or sex or sexuality. The truth that frames and grounds our formation as human beings is that we bear the image of God himself. And that is who we are. That is who we are. And we believe that we flourish when we live in that identity. Then, second, we really have a better story about flourishing itself. But again, we tell a different story about how you get there to our culture. So just let me labour this point. We need to say to folk, I admire that you don't want to drive the little people down. Neither do we. We admire that you want to see people be more, not less. So do we. So can we have a conversation, rather than locking horns, about the difference between us in how we get to that place and quite what it looks like when we get there. True flourishing, we believe, and this is our story of how we get there, isn't found in self-fulfillment. But here's something profoundly countercultural. If we can regain our confidence, it's something that young people might even find attractive because it's self-sacrifice. We believe our erotic longings are there to serve a bigger purpose than me. They serve a common good, a vision that's about the many as well as the few. And so once again, we say we share our society's values of fairness and justice, but we actually just believe that today's liberal individualism, with its focus on minority interests, we just think it fails to serve the many as well as the few. And in focusing on the interests of the few, sometimes it may even risk harming the many. And that's the story, conversation we need to have about gender identity, you see. Because it's no good meeting the needs of a subset of the bees if in doing so we destroy the whole hive. And that's our important message about moral capital. We believe that to thrive, a society needs to have moral capital. I don't know whether you're interested in that term. You know, capital is what's available to us to make more of the world. So the capital in the bank, the money that allows us to buy the shop, to open the business, to move forward, you see. Social capital that sociologists talk about is another source of making more of the world. It's the number of connections that there are in a society. And what sociologists do and social scientists is count the number of connections, and they would say, look, in this society here, it's got quite high social capital because there are lots of clubs and churches and there are community centres and community life. And therefore, we think that this community is more likely to thrive because all of those connections provide opportunities for reciprocity and helping one another out, you see. But I think I'd want to argue, and I noticed that a social psychologist called Jonathan Haidt uses the same term, I'd want to argue that we also need moral capital, because if you've got a society over here, let's call it society A, that has a social capital of a certain amount, 70%, let's say. So it's got pretty good social capital, lots of connections. You've got a society over here, society B, and it's got 70% social capital too. What is there to prevent people over here exploiting those connections for fraud and for theft? And for negative causes, connections, as we well know, can be exploitative. What prevents us using those social connections to harm people is moral capital that sits within a community and generates values that not simply create human contacts, but good human relationships. And there are devices in communities, and we think the church is a pretty good one, but marriage is another, which generate moral capital and that filter down to the little people and take care of the most vulnerable. So we share our culture's vision of flourishing, but we have a profoundly different route for how to get there. It's the route of self-sacrifice. Not self-fulfillment, but we think it works. In the end, we think it works. Then third and finally, we have a story about the real meaning of our erotic longing, and we've talked about moral capital, so I'll just move on because this is virtually my last slide. And I think this is perhaps the real difficulty for us. What's our story about our erotic longings? The bit we don't like to talk about. these deep longings within us for intimacy, for pleasurable love making with somebody. What's the meaning of this? Why is it there? What does it have to do with the stars, with eternity, with heaven, with God? Anything? And of course, we'd say our erotic longings bring joy and satisfaction in the covenant of marriage. But I'd like to suggest our story is a bit deeper and wider, thicker than that. Because these bodily desires, I'd suggest, and marriage itself points to a transcendent reality as well. In fact, I want to be really kind of a bit controversial. I believe these bodily desires are a signpost within our own bodies to where all human history is heading. Where's it heading? To the marriage supper of the Lamb, to the great marriage feast, the consummation, when our hearts, as Augustine said, that are restless till they find their rest in Thee, our deepest longings, of which our erotic longings are perhaps most intense, to love someone, to be loved, in that intense sense of pleasure, union, that'll only ever really fully be realized in the marriage feast. The Lamb, God dwells with His people. When what Paul says, eye hasn't seen, nor ear heard, nor the mind of man conceived of what God has in store. And that makes these erotic longings quite holy. And it helps us understand why we get all awkward about it, because it's partly our shame and the fall, and what the fall did to our relationships. But it's also, we sense sex, there's something holy about it. So we need to get it right. Well, let's start thinking about it and getting it right, and perhaps bringing up a generation of young people who won't be brought up in shame around their sexuality. And of course, there's more to this story about what our erotic longings mean, because we know that when we shepherd our erotic longings rightly, as we're called to in the image of God, whether that's in Christian marriage or in chaste singleness, we are told in Scripture that we put the gospel and the nature of God's love on display to the world in ways that point to the marriage supper of the Lamb. Well, now, what do I mean? Just give me 1 minute. Look at a married couple. They promised that their most intimate love for one another will be a better, for better or worse love, for richer or poorer love, till death us do part love, a faithful love, a covenantal love. Now, whose love is like that? It's God's love. We put God's love on display to the world. We iconize it. We show it as well as tell it in our marriages. And then look at the chastity of the single person here. They too are made in the image of God. They too, if you're a single person, you are sexual. But if you live chastely, you retain the power to love intimately, but in your chastity, you say that if I can't love you faithfully, I won't love you intimately. Because He doesn't do one-night stands. He won't separate covenant from passion, and neither will I. And so in my chaste singleness, I too witness to the marriage supper of the Lamb, just as surely as the married couple, because I put on display what God's love is like in my body. Well, we need to wrap up. Let me finish with this. The question is, how do we live out this radical story in today's culture? What I suggest is that what we have in Matthew 19, and as we unpack it in the kind of story I've tried to set forward, what we have is a blueprint for how we flourish as human beings made in the image of God. Let's recommit to that image, that blueprint, with all our hearts. Let's share it with our kids. Let's regain our confidence that it's life for the world. And in the long run, it's not just life for ourselves, it really is life for everybody. Let's recommit to that. But of course, in the knowledge that none of us builds anything like the perfection and beauty we see in that blueprint. So we're all strugglers. We're all journeying toward what the gospel sets before us. And that means that our communities need to be communities of radical hospitality. Communities that say we want our church to be known as places that will serve you and welcome you and support you no matter what your sexuality, the shape of your family, who you are, what you're wearing, what you look like, where you come from, no matter how broken you are, please let us serve you and come under our tent of hospitality. We want to do that. Just don't ask us to give up our blueprint. We never will. It is our identity. It brings life to the world, and our forebears died for this, partly, and now it's our time to be stand up, be counted. So to come into membership, into full ownership, you have to subscribe to the blueprint. And if you're not ready for that, please don't go away. Let us serve you, no matter what your sexuality or what your family looks like. We're just grace-drenched people here seeking to serve God with our bodies and in our bodies. Now, of course, you'll have lots of questions, but let me finish with this. Maybe we're thinking a little bit that the revival of this Christian moral vision is a pipe dream. I just want to say, I think we've been here before. 2,000 years ago, the belief that Jesus of Nazareth had been raised from the dead inspired small groups of ordinary people. They really did. They looked like us, often persecuted. The belief that Jesus had risen from the dead inspired them to create a culture so attractive to pagans by the way they treated women, children, the sexually exploited, slaves, and the poor, by the way they built moral capital in their own communities and put it on display, and then said, but look, this isn't just for us. We think this is life for the world. So they were outward looking and serving. They put on display something so attractive, a kind of a soft power, that by the end of the 4th century, an entire empire stood on the verge of faith. Of course, many questions remain, but for the sake of the gospel, for the life of the world, to bring justice and equality and fairness to the little people and flourishing, the biblical moral vision is a story we now must be prepared to tell all over again.